Well, I think one of the things that we've learned over many years, George, is that a great many number of skin conditions are actually a true two-edged sword. And I'm thinking, for example, atopic dermatitis, alopecia, areata, psoriasis. Time and again, we've seen those worsened by stress of the individual concerned, and the flares and the triggers seem to be powered up by stress. Hello and welcome to this Rash Decision podcast, where once again we're looking at skin-related issues, conditions and treatments in an interesting and informed way. I'm Dr. Roger Henderson. I'm a GP with a long-standing interest in this particular area of health.
And I'm Dr. George Moncrief. I was also a GP, though I've now retired from my practice. And I'm a former chair of the Dermatology Council for England.
Now, this is the second of three podcasts on the topic of our skin and mental health. And in this podcast, we'll be focusing on certain specific skin conditions and how they can impact on our patients' mental health. And once again, we're fortunate to be joined by our very special guest, Professor Tony Bewley. And if you were with us for the first podcast, you'll know just what a wonderful guest he is. Welcome, Tony.
Thanks very much, Roger. Great to be here.
Now, many skin conditions are a true two-edged sword, and I suppose I'm thinking specifically of the big hitters like atopic dermatitis, psoriasis, alopecia areata, for example, all being worsened by stress. So I just want to run through these in a little bit of detail, and let's start off with a common one we see in our practices, atopic dermatitis.
As we all know, atopic dermatitis commonly involves the face and the hands with these dry, red, scaly, and of course, uncomfortable areas of skin. So it's hardly surprising that has quite a significant impact on how people feel. Itch also can be relentless and often disturbs the quality of sleep. And of course, skincare can consume many hours, as well as all the time taken and the cost of accessing healthcare. A study in 2006 found that over 80% of teenagers with atopic dermatitis avoided at least one everyday activity. And almost a third felt that atopic dermatitis had a negative impact on their schooling. And 40% reported they'd been teased or bullied because of their atopic dermatitis. Another study in 2018 found that atopic dermatitis brought a doubling of the risk of depression and a fourfold increased risk of suicidal ideation. Interestingly and importantly, it also showed that controlling the atopic dermatitis resulted in these risks returning to normal. More recently, a study in 2020 by the National Eczema Society, supported by a pharma company called Leo Pharma, they surveyed over 500 children and 500 adults with atopic dermatitis. And they found that three quarters felt their skin disease impacted negatively on their mental health. And two thirds said that they felt lonely or socially isolated because of their eczema. Worryingly, in this study, a third felt that their healthcare professional did not appreciate the impact that eczema had on their mental health. Atopic dermatitis is a common condition in children, especially young children, but it also affects teenagers. And it can persist into adult life, and about 10% of adults have atopic dermatitis. It's clear from these studies, all of which show alarmingly high levels of mental illness associated with atopic dermatitis, that this area of care for our patients needs to be taken very seriously. It's particularly concerning that the study by the National Eczema Society found that a third of our patients who are affected do not feel that we appreciate the impact it's having on their lives. These findings are really disturbing. Tony, do you have any particular thoughts on atopic dermatitis?
Yeah, I had atopic dermatitis as a child and an adolescent and then grew out of it. And I have the genetics for atopic dermatitis, but I have very little by way of eczema on my skin at the moment. And yeah, no, I fully understand where these young people or adults are coming from. So the association with anxiety and or depression is clear. The association, sadly, with suicidal ideation is also clear. What is interesting is that we as healthcare professionals, again, need to get a little bit better if we get to the point where we think that a patient may have some kind of self-harm type agenda. We do need to address that. We do need to ask that question. So we do need to get better at saying to the patient as sympathetically as we can, are you feeling so wretched that you'd consider harming yourself, or are you feeling so wretched that you'd consider suicide? Now, there are well-validated tools to be able to do this. There is the PHQ-9, and there is the HAD score, the Hospital Anxiety and Depression score, and there is a rather cumbersome tool called the Columbia Suicide Rating Scale, all of which are fine and largely used in research. But actually, really just saying to a patient, how are you feeling? What's going on? You, and I think we've talked about this previously, George, then often you get a really quite a clear sense of where the patient's at.
Yeah.
And then we as healthcare professionals need to not be afraid about opening up that question. Are you feeling so awful that you'd consider suicide, or are you feeling so awful that you'd consider harming yourself in some way? Because if we identify that issue, then we can reduce the risk that the patient will act on that, and also the patient will feel engaged and embrace us and embrace the consultation. And then, of course, with atopic dermatitis, it's the itch and the sleeplessness and the family dysfunction, which is a real issue. And I remember as a child when my parents or people would say to me, for goodness sake, Anthony, will you stop scratching? And it just doesn't help. The itch is irresistible. It's a dreadful itch. So to think that, you know, that some kind of willpower will stop you scratching, fine. But most of the time you're scratching at night. And then if you wake up the following day with blood on your sheets and skin that is got worse overnight, the guilt and the shame that you feel and the out of controlness that you feel is really quite palpable. So that's why the golden rule, really, of psychodermatology is to treat the skin and the psychosocial comorbidities at the same time as early as possible. So it's really important that we do treat the skin and we treat it effectively, making sure that the patient is at the center of that choice. And then we treat the psychosocial comorbidities at the same time. And that might be whatever way we need to treat them. It might be accessing cognitive behavioral therapy. It might just be listening to the patient. It might be considering medication that might help if a patient has clinical anxiety and or depression. Extremely rarely, it might involve a referral to some psychiatric services.
That's incredibly useful. Thank you so much, Tony. I particularly like what you had to say, not only about itch, which I thought was fascinating, but that not to feel afraid to explore thoughts of suicide. What I generally do is I sit back and say, goodness, this is awful. I can't begin to imagine how much you're suffering and how rotten this feels. And if I don't get much from that, I might try and give the patient permission by saying, I've had patients who had disease, perhaps less severe even than yours, who've even considered whether life's worth going on. And so introduce it slowly, gradually, and say, rather than just saying, you know, if you're going to commit suicide, what are you going to do? You've got a rope. But to come at it much more gently and open the dialogue and give the patient permission and suggest areas where, almost saying, encouraging them to tell you about it, that it's okay and that you are ready to hear this.
And one I often use in practice, Tony, is really even simpler, which is, how bad has it got?
Yeah.
And that's a really nice one.
Yeah, I've found nice
because
one.
It gives them carte blanche to just sort of what they want to say.
And I think you allude to a really important point there, George, in that psychosocial comorbidity does not correlate directly with disease extent. In other words, you can have patients with really quite limited disease and they feel absolutely dreadful. And you can have patients with quite severe disease and actually they're coping okay. So we know for sure that psychosocial comorbidities doesn't always link in with disease extent. We also know that if we can get on top of the disease, that can really help with the family dysfunction. So what we do know is that it's not just the patient that is affected by the atopic dermatitis. It's the whole family. If you have a young person with atopic dermatitis who's scratching in the night and up and down and not sleeping and restless and so on, often the parents or the guardians have a similarly disturbed night, and the whole family can find itself very dysfunctional, or other relationships, partners or wives.
And then, of course, the child can't go to school.
Right.
And the parents have to, short notice, find either childcare arrangements or not go to work and things.
Yeah.
Absolute nightmare.
I think that's really salutary, isn't it? It really makes us think and wonder if we are actually doing everything we can for our patients with atopic dermatitis, even just as something as simple as asking how their mental health is. And I said at the top, it's not just atopic dermatitis. Psoriasis, obviously another big one. And for those of you that listen to our psoriasis podcast, in it, I mentioned that one of the reasons I got into dermatology as an interest was because of seeing a patient with psoriasis that really just opened my eyes as to how much it was impacting every single area of his life. And I think you've had similar experiences, haven't you, George?
I have indeed. I vividly recall a talk I heard at the Royal College of Physicians in London. It was given by a lovely guy, Peter Lapsley, who was a good friend of mine, but he sadly died 10 years ago. And this was a talk to dermatologists. And he opened his talk by saying, "I have ischemic heart disease and ongoing angina. I also have type 2 diabetes, and I've got some pretty rotten asthma. Oh, and I also have psoriasis. If I could be rid of one of these wretched conditions." And there he paused. And I think we all assumed he would choose one of the first three major conditions. But to my astonishment, he went on, "It would be the psoriasis." Everyone in the audience was as stunned as I was. He went on to describe how embarrassing it was, especially when he was staying away from home, and in the morning his bed was covered in blood, how he had taken to packing a small Hoover in his overnight bag to cope with the scale he shed on the carpet, how he'd even abandoned going to a public swimming pool as the ignominy of being asked to leave the pool because people didn't like the look of his skin. Psoriasis interfered with every aspect of his life. That really, if nothing else, that really brought it home to me. A study in 2018 looking at patient perceptions about their psoriasis found that 84% had experienced discrimination or even humiliation because of their psoriasis. And over 40% admitted it had affected their relationships, especially intimate relationships. The British Skin Foundation has previously highlighted how psoriasis impacts every aspect of everyday life. The Dermatology Life Quality Index, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, was originally developed as a tool to measure this impact in people with psoriasis. And this intentionally explores issues such as embarrassment, choice of clothes, social or leisure activities, and relationships. In 2012, the See Psoriasis Look Deeper campaign highlighted these issues for patients with psoriasis. And they quoted figures of 77% describing this having an impact on their quality of life. 20% of patients with severe psoriasis were taking antidepressants. And about a third had experienced depression or anxiety. 20% had felt rejected and stigmatized. And look at this, 10% of patients had contemplated suicide. That is absolutely shocking. And I wonder, Tony, have you got any particular comments here regarding psoriasis?
Yeah, that's right. And the patients with psoriasis often behave entirely different from patients with atopic dermatitis. Dermatology healthcare professionals are very clear that if you go into a waiting room, you can think without looking at the patient's skin, because of the way the patient behaves, you can think, okay, that patient probably has psoriasis, that patient probably has atopic dermatitis. So patients with psoriasis probably do behave differently from patients with atopic dermatitis. And in particular, we know that something called alexithymia is particularly common in patients with psoriasis. Alexithymia is the kind of inability or the reduced ability to be able to access what you're really thinking. So for example, and I always use this example, I have a friend who has psoriasis, and he went to a party and another friend of his was there who also has psoriasis. And he said to his friend, let's call her Georgia. He said to his friend, Georgia, you know, how are you doing? And Georgia said, I'm all right. And my friend said, okay, I know you've got psoriasis and I've got psoriasis. How are you doing? And she said, oh, I'm all right. You know, and then he asked for a third time, look, you know, I know it's a real struggle when you've got psoriasis. How are you doing? And at that point, she broke down in tears and, you know, things weren't all right at all. So alexithymia then is the relative inability to be able to really understand or be able to express for yourself, to access for yourself, and then be explicit about what's going on. And that matters for us as healthcare professionals, because sometimes we have to dig a little bit deeper with patients who we know may be struggling with thymia. And then the second thing to remember about alexithymia is that it gets worse if you get depressed and or anxious. So the greater the depression, the greater the alexithymia. But I go back again to the point we mentioned a bit earlier on, which was about the golden rule of psychodermatology, which is treating the skin condition and the psychosocial comorbidities at the same time and as early as possible and as comprehensively as possible, remembering to keep the patient at the center of the decision making. What is interesting about psoriasis, particularly these days, is that there is a growing momentum of interest in neuroinflammation. So the whole concept that the anxiety and depression that patients with psoriasis may experience may be related to neuro changes, so brain changes, and not about neurotransmitter changes. So we know that the idea of neuroinflammation, the brain being involved and part of the inflammatory process, can be relevant. And there is a growing body of evidence that is explaining the anxiety and depression associated with psoriasis, which may be neuroinflammatory in origin. And that's quite helpful to patients, because patients often feel guilty and stigmatized about having mental health disease as well as skin disease. So if you take away that stigma and say, well, do you know, it's not your fault that you're feeling like this, it is part of the inflammatory process, then patients can actually find that quite, well, A, therapeutically appealing, and B, relieving, really. You know, their shoulders drop and they think, okay, all these years of struggling, actually, at least part of it is to do with neuroinflammation.
That's fascinating. That's really absolutely extraordinary. Yeah, I wasn't aware of that. I think actually something that our listeners may find really powerful, and I certainly found it incredibly powerful when I first watched it, and I watched it about over 20 times now, and I'm sure you know this, it's a YouTube called Psoriasis, The Skin I'm In. So you just look up on Google, you just go YouTube, and then you put the word psoriasis, and then The Skin I'm In. It's an initially slightly irritating format in which the way they present it, but it's two actors talking as if they've got psoriasis to each other, and it's graphically illustrated with rather strange drawings and things. It's about 11 minutes long, but I would say if you're going to go and watch it in private, close the door, because I still, when I watch it over 20 times, it brings tears to my eyes. It's a very powerful piece. Really does bring home to you what it feels like to have a condition that people can see, that they are revolted by often, and the humiliation and the embarrassment it can cause, as well as all these other elements as well that Tony's been highlighting.
Well, those are two enormous areas, atopic dermatitis and psoriasis. But we mustn't forget a third one. And this brings this to mind just because it was one of the last patients I saw in my surgery yesterday, an 18-year-old with pretty dreadful acne. And I have to be perfectly honest that the doctors who'd seen them previously had not covered themselves in glory with both their treatments and their attitude. And acne is so common. I think that some people can consider it as normal and trivialize it. Nothing could be further from the truth, in my view. It can hardly develop at a more devastating time in someone's life, especially during the teen years. It's a long time ago for us. But think back to our teen years, just how important things like validation with your peers, fitting in, is at that sort of time in your life. And if you've got a facially disfiguring, often painful condition, such as acne, especially if it's severe, then it can inevitably have dire consequences on self-esteem, on relationships, mood, and even choice of career and career opportunities. So there's almost this unholy trinity, I think, we're looking at, of atopic dermatitis, psoriasis, and acne.
Acne comes at a pretty devastating time in people's lives. And if it affected people our sort of age, who've got stable relationships and careers behind them, it wouldn't be quite so disastrous, but it occurs in teenagers and young adults. And for them, how you look, particularly how you look on social media, how your face looks and so on, my heart goes out to them. And hardly surprisingly, studies have repeatedly shown strong links between acne and mental health problems, including depression and suicide attempts. It's a complicated area, complicated to some extent, because the best treatment we have for acne and the treatment that gives complete control, such that the majority of patients never have any more acne, no more antibiotics, no more doctor's appointments, no more treatment, no more acne, is, of course, isotretinoin. And rightly, there are concerns about the use of isotretinoin because of reports of this drug being associated with patients committing suicide. And it's a thorny issue that taxes us, the profession, quite significantly. I was reassured by a huge meta-analysis published in the BMJ in 2019 that concluded that those patients whose acne was causing such severe depression that they were already contemplating suicide, or even patients with just severe depression, because isotretinoin is the most effective treatment we have for them, controlling their acne with isotretinoin was the right thing to do for this group. Clearly, they needed to be monitored more carefully. But the use of isotretinoin significantly improves depressive symptoms in patients with depression, already got depression associated with their acne. And I was intrigued by a paper published in 2022, which concluded that isotretinoin was not independently associated with adverse neuropsychiatric outcomes at the population level. Indeed, they found that the risk of significant neuropsychiatric outcomes, such as depression or suicide, was worse with oral or topical antibiotics, probably because those aren't controlling the acne, whereas the patients on isotretinoin had control. Now, this is a thorny issue, and I think it's not one that we can go into in great detail here, but clearly managing the acne effectively, which may involve using isotretinoin, resulted in better overall outcomes, including lower suicide rates. But there are going to be some patients, almost certainly, very rare, where the isotretinoin played a part in them deciding to commit suicide. But if you look at the population level, it's doing more good than harm. And I think this is an area that's going to continue to be really difficult for us all. And I think it's one that we have to watch this space. I think the important thing is to be sure that patients who are prescribed this get the right degree of monitoring during the course and for a year afterward. It's a very important element of their management. So hearing all that, Tony, It's a really difficult issue, isn't it? We have a drug that works, but it could have problems. And this is a condition affecting young people and having a big impact on their self-esteem, their relationships, as well as causing depression and suicidal thoughts inevitably. Have you got any particular words of wisdom for us?
Yeah, I think acne is a pernicious disease, isn't it? And it's often underweighted. We as healthcare professionals can sometimes consider it to be somewhat lesser than it is. but it's a pernicious disease for our patients. It really, really matters. And it tends to strike at an age. Its perniciousness is at least partly related to the age it strikes, which is adolescence usually, or early adulthood, though we are beginning to understand that there is a group of usually women who get later onset acne in their 30s.
Yes.
And that is interesting too. But it's a pernicious disease because it's sore, it's obvious that you've got acne, and it strikes at an age when your body is changing and you're trying to come to terms with a changing body and changing dynamics with your peers and with partners and an increasing awareness of sexuality. So it's not surprising then that the psychosocial comorbidities of living with acne are huge. And one thing we do know is that acne strikes together often with body dysmorphic disorder. Body dysmorphic disorder is that condition where you have a change on your skin and your focus on that change is in excess of the disease extent. So it can be acne scarring, it can be milder acne, but the patients often feel very, very debilitated with recurring thoughts about their appearance, huge amounts of time mirror checking or huge amounts of time avoiding mirrors, and often social avoidance. So they might stay at home and not go into school because their acne is bad or whatever it might be. And then they might hide their skin and believe narratives that aren't necessarily the case. So, for example, if they're on a bus and somebody moves away from them, they can assume that that person has moved away from them because they perceived the acne and believed it to be ugly. And so they've moved away because of the acne. So there can be narratives that people construct which aren't necessarily at all what was happening in reality. So it's a pernicious disease and it needs to be treated. And again, I go back to the golden rule of psychodermatology, which is to treat the skin disease appropriately and to treat the psychosocial comorbidities at the same time. So for milder acne, it's absolutely right to start treating with topical agents, and then you step up to systemic anti-inflammatories, and you can consider contraceptive medications, and then you can step up to other treatments, and eventually you can step up to isotretinoin. And there is no doubt that isotretinoin is an effective drug for the management of acne. However, we need to be very respectful of isotretinoin because there is an association, not a proof, but an association with mood changes and with changes in impulsivity. In other words, an association with either acquiring or acting on suicidal ideation. As a consequence, and I think we've alluded to this, the MHRA and the British Association of Dermatologists have made it very clear that we as healthcare professionals need to do a very careful assessment before a patient goes on to isotretinoin and then during the isotretinoin treatment. However, I would argue that we need to be doing that for all of our patients with acne anyway. So we need to be very mindful about the psychosocial comorbidities, whatever the patient, whether they have mild acne or moderate or severe acne, remembering that, and we talked about this earlier on in the podcasts, remembering that disease extent does not necessarily correlate with psychosocial comorbidities. Sure. Yeah. So for all of these treatments and for the patient, we need to be respectful about what's going on. And if a patient does present with anxiety and or depression together with, in this case, acne, then that becomes the co-priority. So the skin and the psychosocial comorbidities becomes the co-priority at that point.
Well, that's the unholy trinity, the atopic dermatitis, the acne, the psoriasis. But again, thinking of patients I've seen in the last few days, alopecia areata, mustn't forget that one. And if ever there's a condition where there's often such a clear link between stressful life events and the onset or worsening of alopecia, then in my book, there are very few worse than that. And I'm sure you've seen that many times in your practice, George.
I have, yes. And the fairly sudden appearance of patches of hair loss on the scalp, it's so visible, isn't it?
Yeah.
And no surprise, it can have quite a dramatic impact. And that's borne out by studies. A study looking at people with this condition in 2022 found that they had a 38% higher risk of depression and a 33% higher risk of anxiety, as well as needing more time off work and unemployment. Alopecia areata, we all know, often affects young people, and the relapses are unpredictable. And in our society, where hair plays such a critical role, and Roger, I think you and I both agree that's something we're painfully aware of, significant patches of hair loss can have a potentially devastating impact on self-confidence and mental well-being. Almost certainly, stress plays a role in causing relapses. So a vicious cycle can rapidly develop. A study in 2023 showed that a history of major depressive disorder increases the risk of developing alopecia areata by 90%. And alopecia areata increases the risk of major mental illness by 34%.
Yeah, mustn't forget rosacea here. As we all know, permanent background redness of the face is its hallmark, and you can get really sudden, unpleasant, embarrassing facial flushing, plus inflammatory patterns. You get the red angry pimples and the pustules. And again, if you haven't listened to the podcast that George and I did on rosacea, then do go back and have a listen, because we covered this in great detail. But obviously, there's no doubt it can have a major impact on self-esteem, increase the risk of depression or anxiety. And I suspect, Tony, this might be why you've recently done quite a major body of work on this. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. And it's common, you know, Roger, that's the thing. It's such a common condition. And also, it's actually quite symptomatic. So patients talk about the flushing and the heat and the stinging and the burning sensation that they get. And in terms of psychodermatology, one of the things that they particularly allude to is the absence of control. You know, I've taken the diet, I've stopped alcohol, I don't go to steamy places, I don't sit in the jacuzzi. Why is my skin doing this to me? So the out of control sensation can also contribute to that. So with rosacea, again, we start talking about making sure that we recognize the physical issues, and the physical issues can be different for different patients. It can be the papular rosacea, and then we need to treat that with anti-inflammatories, or it can be the erythrotelangiectatic form of rosacea, where there is persistent redness, and that can be fixed redness, or it can be flushing and then relative pallor or relative lack of flushing. And it can be the symptoms that go with that. And sometimes if you have quite extensive disease, it can become more phytomatous. In other words, you can get sebaceous hyperplasia, which can involve, you know, the nose and various parts of the face. So rosacea, again, quite a pernicious condition. And again, I allude back to the golden rule of psychodermatology, which is to treat the skin and the psychosocial comorbidities at the same time. Now, the psychosocial comorbidities for rosacea are really around the out-of-controlness, the anxiety and or depression, but also it's about the symptoms. So it's about recognizing and not dismissing the symptoms of rosacea, the flushing, the burning, the soreness and so on. So treating that as well as the rosacea itself. So that's all really quite important.
Of course, in our society, having a red face has all sorts of connotations. People assume, or the patient imagines people assume, that it's because you've been drinking too much alcohol. And we are aware that alcohol can be one of the triggers for a flush, although in my experience it's not the most important by any means. I think it's ultraviolet light and it's stress and embarrassment and temperature changes and foods and things. And I when I ask about triggers, I always put alcohol at the very, very bottom of my list, partly because I'm conscious that my patients probably think that if they come in with a face that's a bit red, they don't want them to think that I'm assuming they're alcoholic.
And those value judgments and those narratives, those myths that come into patients' experience can be really destabilizing.
Absolutely. So
we know that kind of that knee-jerk response to think, oh, well, you've got rosacea, do you drink too much? can be really unfortunate.
It's terrible, isn't it?
But it's not just in rosacea, it's also in other conditions. For example, like vitiligo, there can be narratives that come into vitiligo. Oh, well, you know, you've got vitiligo because you've eaten the wrong food. You've eaten, so there is a narrative around which is incorrect, that you get vitiligo from eating fish and dairy together. And there is misperceptions about the absence of pigmentation. So you have vitiligo In fact, people can mistake that for being something else, like leprosy, or it could
be
other conditions or an infection. So people, other people, and in fact patients, can construct unhelpful narratives that add to their burden, if you like. And it is important for us as healthcare professionals to say, okay, what do you understand by rosacea or vitiligo? What do you think is going on? And give the patients an opportunity to say, well, I have heard such and such, or I wondered about whether this was some kind of punishment, some kind of, I don't know, supernatural punishment for not living my life as well as I should do. Yeah. You're then in the opportunity to say, okay, well, actually, facts, the science behind this is that rosacea, for example, is caused largely by vasodilation and nerves within the cutaneous microvasculature that allow vasodilation, and actually it's largely genetic, but it's just the way you're made. But we can treat this, and we can treat this and the psychosocial comorbidities at the same time.
Well, running through this long list of skin criminals that can impact on our patients' mental health, vitiligo and birthmarks are perhaps two that I'd thought about that we mustn't forget, again, exactly because they can be so visible. And unfortunately, if you have someone with a very significant birthmark on their face, for example, or a big patch of vitiligo, you do see other people just staring at them. And it's a horrible thing to see. So, George, I think just touching briefly on these two, vitiligo and birthmarks, we do have some work showing just how much they can impact people's mental health, don't we?
Yes, and it should be no surprise to us whatsoever. They are very often on the face. And vitiligo, particularly in dark skin, if someone's got dark skin, the patches of total depigmentation are quite dramatic and dramatically disfiguring. And a study in 2021 showed 76% experienced stress, 78% anxiety, and 80% depression, which they attribute to their vitiligo. Very high figures indeed. It's a disfiguring condition. Regarding birthmarks, especially on the face, things like port wine stains, I'm thinking those can be really devastating and very hard to manage as well. Again, it's hardly surprising people affected by this will have an impact, a marked impact on their mental health. I'm sure this isn't a comprehensive list. There are many other things, but what we've tried to pick out is some of the more obvious things that we can think of that involve the visible areas, because they're going to have a bigger impact. But it's also genital areas. If you've got disease in the genital area, then that can inevitably have a big impact on people's relationships. And they may not want to discuss that with you. They will disclose it. We may need to be quite sensitive and even ask some very open, careful, open questions to divine just how much trouble it's causing. So, for example, psoriasis commonly involves the genital area, but other conditions like lichen sclerosis, which we could cover in another podcast, perhaps, Roger, can be very itchy. And you can imagine how awkward it is if you've got an itch in that area. Our society doesn't think it's acceptable. It might be acceptable to scratch your elbow, but it's not exactly acceptable to grope around in your groin and scratch there.
Yeah. And what I would say is that it's really important that patients don't suffer in silence. And it's really important that we as healthcare professionals fully weight the experience of the patient.
You couldn't have said a more important statement right at the end there. We so endorse that one, you're not on your own. Two, you shouldn't suffer in silence. You must make this the purpose of coming to talk to a healthcare professional, seek help. And then for physicians, in our next podcast, we're going to reflect on our approach, how our approach can be improved, and how we should be looking at helping our patients. But Tony, thank you so much. I have learned so much from you, as I always do when I'm at your knees. And it's been absolutely brilliant. I'm sure Roger will endorse that.
Absolutely. It's been wonderful, Tony. It's been an absolute delight. And thank you so much for your time with us.
Thanks, guys. Always a pleasure.
Well, I do hope that you found this chat with myself, George, and Tony about skin and mental health interesting. And as always, our thanks do go to our wonderful guest, Tony Bewley, for all his help with it. Now, next time, we'll discuss a few conditions where the skin can be the presentation of a mental health condition. But we have discussed some pretty shocking facts and statistics.
one of the things that Tony highlighted, which I took home, was that if you can control the skin condition, so for example, if you've got eczema and you use emollients properly and you manage the eczema well, then that's going to be the best treatment for any mental health complications that the eczema might have caused. Same with acne, the same with psoriasis. So managing the skin condition really well is very, very important here. But we've been really honoured to be joined by Tony for this episode. It's been absolutely brilliant. And once again, thank you so much for your expertise and wisdom. And we really are looking forward to you joining us for our last podcast in this series next time, where we'll be discussing how the medical professions can help patients with these problems. So Roger and I do hope you'll join us for the next podcast. And we'd also like to thank our sponsor, Aproderm, for all their help in putting these Rash Decision podcasts together. We couldn't have done it without them.
And don't forget, do get in touch. We'd love to hear your feedback. Or rate and review us. It really does help us in putting these podcasts together. But until the next time, it's goodbye from George.
Goodbye.
And as always, it's goodbye from me. Goodbye.